A huge win for Christian schools and parental rights at the Supreme Court of Canada.
The one-size-fits-all approach that Alberta's used through Bill 10 last week, that Manitoba used in Bill 18 last year, and which Ontario used through Bill 13 2 years ago, all of those are one-size-fits-all approaches in which they impose a secular approach to sexual ethics on all schools. And what this judgment says is that doesn't work, that's not reasonable. You need to make room for independent Christian schools to teach about ethics from their own worldview.
On the feature interview today, Andre Schouten on the Loyola decision. We'll also look at that decision on the news portion of the program. And there's an interesting court decision about freedom of religion rights in an American court. Also on the show, an update on the No to Trudeau campaign that launched in BC earlier this month, and a story out of Windsor, Ontario, involving what some see as inadequate criminal prosecution in the case of a murder involving a pregnant woman.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
It took about a year, but the Supreme Court of Canada has finally issued its ruling in the so-called Loyola case. At issue was the basic question of whether a Catholic high school in Quebec had a right to opt out of teaching the Quebec government's ethics and religious culture program, or at least whether the school had a right to adapt the basics of that program to allow the material to be taught from a historic Catholic perspective. And the Supreme Court said that, yes, it did have that right. That part of the ruling was unanimous. The justices cited the Freedom of Religion Clause in the Constitution. Let me quote from part of the ruling. The Quebec government, the ruling said, would have, quote, required Loyola to teach Catholicism, the very faith that animates its character, from a neutral perspective. Although the state's purpose is secular, this amounts to requiring a Catholic institution to speak about its own religion in terms defined by the state rather than by its own understanding. This demonstrably interferes with the manner in which members of an institution formed for the purpose of transmitting Catholicism can teach and learn about the Catholic faith. It also undermines the liberty of the members of the community who have chosen to give effect to the collective dimension of their religious beliefs by participating in a denominational school. That's the end of the quote. Douglas Farrell is a religious studies professor at McGill University. And he says, really, the ruling is an affirmation of the right to hold a specific worldview in education.
You can't ask Catholics in principle to be part-time Catholics. You know, Loyola understands itself to be teaching even phys ed in a Catholic way. Why wouldn't it teach a course in ethics and religious culture and, you know, that sort of thing in a Catholic way?
Farrell says the decision also sends a message to politicians when it comes to writing educational policies.
Signals are being sent by the court that governments will have to be very careful in interfering in the freedom of these communities.
There was another part of the ruling that wasn't unanimous, and that involved the way in which Loyola specifically should or shouldn't be teaching about religions other than Catholicism. This is where the ruling gets a little bit complicated. Andre Schouten will sort that part out for us on the feature interview later in the program. Also an interesting court ruling out of the States this week. Denver, Colorado, to be precise. It involves a family-owned heating and ventilation company down there, Hercules Industries. The company is owned by William James and Paul Newland and Christina Ketterhagen. The four of them are Catholic, and they filed suit 3 years ago to opt out of the so-called mandates of what's commonly known as Obamacare, the new federal health insurance plan in the States. Specifically, those mandates would force all companies to provide insurance that includes coverage for sterilization and contraception. The owners of the company objected on religious grounds, and this week a judge in Denver issued a permanent injunction preventing Colorado's Department of Health and Human Services from collecting the insurance premiums or penalizing the company for refusing to pay up. The ruling is important in the context of defining religious freedoms. Many court rulings in the past have limited those freedoms to individuals only, the notion that people are free to practice their religion inside their church, but not in the public square. This ruling expands that notion to include the idea that personal conscience matters can extend to the way Christians run their businesses. The company first obtained a temporary injunction in 2012. This latest ruling makes it permanent, although it's still not clear whether this might be appealed to a higher court. Back here in Canada, the No to Trudeau campaign is continuing. You recall that a few weeks ago we spoke with Jonathan Van Maren from the Canadian Centre for Bioethical Reform about a national tour they're doing to highlight Justin Trudeau's absolute refusal to even allow any pro-lifers to stand for Liberal nominations in advance of this fall's election. Campaign Life is also part of the tour, and that group's Alyssa Golub says the third stop on the tour in Chilliwack, B.C. last week shows the momentum is building.
It was amazing in Chilliwack. We definitely had more people than we have had in the last two talks. People are getting really excited. They're getting really motivated. They're all becoming active in some way, either using their time, treasure, or talent to this campaign, which will definitely give it the teeth that it needs to succeed. And I'm looking forward to the future if this is what is in store for the other talks.
The media is also starting to pick up on this tour, but the spin isn't quite accurate. There have been predictions, for example, that somehow the campaign might bring out a sympathy vote for Justin Trudeau, or that it might be seen as some kind of closet campaign on behalf of the Conservative Party. Jonathan Van Maren says that kind of analysis is wrong on both fronts.
We don't launch a campaign this big without knowing what we're doing first. So politically speaking, we've tried this campaign both in New Brunswick and several other places, and we've seen no sympathy vote emerge. We actually did polling using a federal pollster to determine whether or not there was any backlash. In fact, we saw a slight decrease in support rather than any sort of surge in sympathy vote. Second of all, when it comes to whether or not we're trying to help the Conservatives, we are certainly trying to help pro-life MPs, but I think that the Canadian Centre for Bioethical Reform especially escapes that criticism when you consider the fact that in 2013, we launched our Face the Children campaign, and we were focusing on the fact that Harper was using his prime ministerial powers to shut down pro-life voices in his own caucus. When I pointed this out to the journalist who wrote the one article saying that there would be some sort of a backlash, she evaporated very quickly into the Twitter sphere. So I think that anybody who takes a reasonably longer than 3-minute look at our record when we do different campaigns, when we confront the public, they'll see that we're obviously not in support of any politician who wants to shut down the abortion debate, or in Justin Trudeau's case, enforce the status quo with everything he's got.
Bottom line, Alyssa Golub says this is only a partisan campaign to the extent that Justin Trudeau has made this a partisan issue.
To send a message to the Liberal Party that we have campaigned and helped pro-life Liberals in the past, but because of your extreme pro-abortion policies, we have to oppose you at every level so that pro-life Liberals can be elected and even run in the future.
The tour continues this week with stops in Saskatoon on Tuesday, Regina on Wednesday, and Brandon and Winnipeg on Friday and Saturday. And one thing more today out of Windsor, Ontario, a case that's reigniting the discussion about the lack of criminal code provisions to allow murderers to be charged with two offenses in the death of a pregnant woman. We Need a Law's Mike Schutten says this happens more often than you might think. About 18 cases like this in Canada in the past 10 years, including the one in Windsor in December of last year.
There was a young woman, Cassandra Cake. She was murdered. Her body left in a burnt-out home. When firefighters came to the home, they found out that she was actually 30 weeks pregnant at the time of her passing. The community in Windsor was quite upset when they found out that the person who was being sought by the police would only be charged with one murder.
Mike ended up writing an op-ed on the need for a change in the law, which was published in the Windsor Star earlier this year, and he says that's brought about some interesting reaction.
Since that time, the family has reached out to us asking for some advice because they recognize that obviously we're advocates for preborn human rights, and support has just continued from the Windsor area. People have been starting online petitions. People have been starting Facebook pages, Molly Matters on Facebook. And also last week, a childhood friend of Cassandra Cake, the murdered woman, started a written petition campaign.
Fundamentally, he says, the campaign is now centering on the need to reintroduce an amendment to the criminal code that was first suggested about 7 years ago.
In 2008, Ken Epp put forward an Unborn Victims of Crime Act. This would see an addition to the criminal code whereby police could lay a second murder charge for people who killed a pregnant woman. This bill passed at second reading, had cross-party support. In fact, even Prime Minister Harper voted in favor of it. But unfortunately, an election was called, and when an election's called, all pieces of legislation die on the order paper. So it's never been revived, and the family is urging their MPs, as well as all Canadians, to build support so that that piece of legislation can be reintroduced.
In addition to the Facebook page, there's also a petition up at change.org. We've got that link up on our website. More after this.
Please save the date. for the National March for Life in Ottawa on Thursday, May 14th. We will be sending more details in the coming weeks, so if you don't already receive our emails, please sign up at arpacanada.ca. We hope to see you in Ottawa for the Reformed Prayer Service and March for Life on Thursday, May 14th.
And we're back on the program, and with me today is Andre Schutten. He's ARPA's lawyer based in Ottawa. ARPA was part of the team making submissions to the Supreme Court of Canada on the Loyola case. The ruling, as you heard in the news, came down this week. Andre, you've got to be a little bit excited, at least initially, at what that ruling looked like.
Yeah, for sure, Al. It was exciting to read the decision. I had the opportunity to have advanced viewing of the decision in a council lockup that morning, and very happy to see that the Supreme Court has agreed that it's unreasonable for a provincial government to insist that a religious school, a Roman Catholic school in this case, cannot teach its own faith from its own religious perspective.
It's kind of a double-edged ruling, though. I mean, the court was unanimous on, I think, that part of it. Correct me if I'm wrong. But there was another piece of the puzzle there that wasn't quite as positive. Maybe explain that to us.
It is a unanimous ruling in the sense that all seven judges that participated in this judgment all agreed that Loyola was wronged by the Minister of Education in this instance. But it was two concurring judgments, a majority judgment, four judges, and a minority concurring judgment of three. And the bigger group, the group of four, said, yes, indeed, the minister infringed on Loyola by insisting that they teach their own faith from a secular perspective. But that majority also said it was not unreasonable for the Minister of Education to tell Loyola to teach about other faiths from a secular perspective, or from as neutral a perspective as possible. And the minority, the concurring judgment of the other three, written by Chief Justice McLaughlin, actually, that minority said, well, it would have been unreasonable also to insist that they teach about other religions from a neutral or secular perspective. I would have preferred that the minority had been the majority, obviously. I think that the reality is that every teacher, every school, whether they are secular or Christian or Islamic, they're always going to teach about other religions from their own perspective. Now, a point of clarification here, and that is, I think that we're kind of missing each other. The majority decision was written by Justice Abella, and I think what she thinks is objective is different than what most of us would think is objective. If she means by teaching objectively about other religions, if she means by that that we have to teach about the factual realities of other religions, for example, the five pillars of Islam or the eightfold path of Buddhism, well, that's fine. That's exactly what a Christian school is going to do when they're teaching about other religions anyway. We're going to be factually accurate. That is, if we're teaching about, let's say, Islam in our classroom and we had an imam sitting in that class, they should be able to say, yes, what you're presenting is accurate. That is my religion. But if she means by objective, as in we cannot then later critique that religion from our own worldview, well, then I don't think we can do that. So I think she means the former. I think she means we just got to be factually accurate, in which case I would agree with her ruling.
So it really comes down to whether schools have the freedom to apply their worldview lens when they're teaching ethics and religion and culture, correct?
Yes, exactly. That's fundamentally what's at stake. And I like that this one goes beyond just religion. It's also about ethics and culture. And ethics is particularly important, especially as we start looking beyond Quebec, looking at other provinces when it comes to education.
Which leads to sort of the follow-up question. I saw a clip from you on Global News the day the decision was released. And I saw the release that ARPA put out, which basically says this opens the door for us to put some pressure on some of the other provinces with respect to what they're doing. Bill 10 in Alberta comes to mind. Global had instantly taken the leap of logic that said this is now going to be the basis for a whole bunch more court challenges. I don't think that's entirely correct.
Not what I meant to imply with my statement. What I did say was that we'll be able to take this judgment and go to the provincial governments and say to them, listen, the Supreme Court has just said you have to make room for religious schools. You have to make room for religious schools to teach about ethics, in the case of Alberta, sexual ethics, from their own Christian worldview. The one-size-fits-all approach that Alberta's used through Bill 10 last week, that Manitoba used in Bill 18 last year, and which Ontario used through Bill 13 2 years ago, all of those are one-size-fits-all approaches in which they impose a secular approach to sexual ethics on all schools. And what this judgment says is that doesn't work. That's not reasonable. You need to make room for independent Christian schools to teach about ethics from their own worldview.
Let me ask you something else. ARPA was one of the interveners in this case, or at least, you know, you as the ARPA staff lawyer representing more than 300 Christian schools. How much or how many of the arguments that were put forward in the ARPA presentation, the ARPA factum, ended up being reflected in the final judgment?
There's at least three main thrusts that I think got picked up by the court. For example, the court makes reference to parental rights. They spend a good page, a few paragraphs on that, which was really nice to see. And Loyola School did not advance any sort of argument on parental rights. So that's obviously coming from ourselves and from the HSLDA, that's the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. As well, we advanced the argument that the state can only interfere with beliefs or practices of a religious group if they conflict with or harm overriding public interests. And we took that from an earlier religious freedom case. And the Supreme Court picked up on that as well in paragraph 43 of their judgment. And finally, we emphasized repeatedly, we kept talking about the core of what it means to be a confessional school, and that undermining the character of lawful religious institutions is unreasonable. And the court echoes that in, for example, paragraph 67. So there's a few places where the court's picking up on some of the arguments we made.
That's got to make you feel pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. No, and we're very thankful that we were able to have this coalition of over 300 independent Christian schools, that all of those schools and the associations that represented them were willing to work with us. It was an honor and a privilege to be able to represent them, and we're very thankful to the Lord for blessing all the work that went into it.
Andre, we're out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Al.
This has been Lighthouse News, delivering news and commentaries on today's current events to equip Christians for their task in the public square. Production Manager Brian Grimm, Technical Director Nate Boscher. Questions or feedback? You can leave us an audio comment by clicking on the answering machine button at the top of the Lighthouse News homepage, or you can send us an email, info@arpaccanada.ca. Be sure to join us again next week for another edition of Lighthouse News.